Just a reminder, the content of this show is for informational purposes only. Please visit blockstack.org/legal/disclaimers for more info. Hi there, and welcome to the Stacks Podcast. I'm Zach Valente. Today's episode features a conversation between Ari Paul, the cryptocurrency investor and co-founder of Block Tower Capital, who also serves as its chief investment officer, and Maniba Lee, co-founder and CEO of Blockstack PPC. Ari and Manib cover a variety of crypto developments, both from a political science and distributed systems engineering perspective. They focus particularly on the issues of sharding for scalability and the challenges of digital asset custody. And now, here's Ari and Manib.
Hey Ari, great to have you here. Like I'm just thinking back to the first time I met you. I think it was Consensus in 2017, and Naval hosted some sort of an event. And Naval, like that man, like never travels for conferences, never shows up anywhere. And I was surprised that he was at a crypto event. And I meet him, Naval, if you don't know, he's one of the early backers of Blockstack, one of the first people who wrote us a check. And he goes like, there's someone I really want you to meet. And it turned out to be you, and you were still at the managing and the University of Chicago Endowment at that time. Why don't you tell us a little bit about how you got started in crypto?
Oh, sure. Well, I'll keep this part really brief because it's boring. And just to clarify, I was a portfolio manager at UChicago, but I worked under the guy who ran the whole thing. In the endowment world, you need gray hair usually to, it's much less meritocratic than crypto. It's much more resume. So, well, yeah, let me just say on the meeting, you and Naval, that was also the first time I met Naval. I wasn't really in the crypto world at that time. I'd been investing for a few years, but that was actually the first conference I ever went to. And it was kind of mind-blowing to me because these were like, I mean, quite literally, the people at that conference, you, Naval, Juan Benet, were all kind of idols to me. Just these were the people changing the world. It was like very much like being in the garage with Bill Gates and Steve Jobs. Really very cool to see. Like, I don't really fanboy over celebrities. I fanboy over like cryptographers. And I was so excited about cryptocurrency and to be introduced and to be meeting people, who are the leaders in the industry doing the really fascinating work was amazing and very weird for me to be almost instantly treated as an equal, which was totally inappropriate and still is today. There aren't many industries or asset classes where you can basically show up and be, you know, talking with the leaders almost immediately, who just on the basis mostly of curiosity, I think, right? It's a little tougher today, post 2017, you know, it's a little more crowded. I imagine you probably got more inbound, but I'll give you an example. So in early 2017, I reached out to Zuko Wilcox on Earn.com, and he had posted on Twitter his email. And I paid $100, sent him a message that just said, "Hey Zuko, I'm just curious about what you're doing. I just want to chat with you and see if I can be helpful. I'm a PM at UChicago. I don't know that I can be helpful, but I would just love to pick your brain." And he wrote back on Earn.com without giving me another contact method. He said, "Oh, I'd love to chat. You're the first Wall Street guy to ever reach out to me." So I then sent him another $100 message saying, "Hey, Zuko, please send me an email here." And we chatted. But the funny thing was, like, you know, Zuko Wilcox, creator of Zcash, one of the top projects, no one from Wall Street had ever reached out to him. It wasn't like I was a big name or anything. It was just like, oh, like the only people who knew him were cryptographers, right? I think, you know, post 2017 that changed, but it's still an amazing space for someone who's just new and curious, right?
No, it changed massively, I think. 2016, if at a conference like me, Juan or Zuko would be chatting, I think at one point we all stayed at Juan's place and imagine like we were just going, getting coffee in the morning and chatting about, you know, technology stuff, peer-to-peer networks. And if you would do that in 2017, it would be a completely different world, right? Like that these projects that now, well, I think Zcash had a public ticker by that time already, or Filecoin was raising. So what are you up to these days? Like, what's the most exciting thing or the stuff that is kind of like piquing your interest?
Well, two very different questions. So the day-to-day, I have to imagine probably somewhat similarly for you, is filled with a lot of things that are not the fun part of what we do. So a lot of regulatory compliance and operations and legal and all of that. The fun part, I'm fascinated by governance, which is becoming, I think over the next 2 years is going to be a prime focus. We have a bunch of proof of stake networks launching. We have just all sorts of experimentation in every form, whether it's Aragon and smart contracts and smart contracts, you have the DAOs kind of resurfacing. I was a poli-sci major in college. It's also one area of crypto that I can actually is accessible to me, you know, because I can't really dive too deeply into the cryptography. So really excited about that, trying to, you know, think it through. I also am fascinated by security models. We did a lot of diligence on custodians, for example, and the two are connected, at least in my mind, from because that's what it's all about ultimately, is kind of security models as they relate to people interacting with technology. And you get kind of really interesting effects as the hybrid. And I think a lot of people in the crypto world are very good on the tech side, but I'll use a minor example. Trying to assess the risk of like a 51% attack is this mix of the tech with kind of thinking about cartel formation and hard friction and all of that stuff. And I know you're a you know, formal game theorist, but a lot of people in crypto, I mean, not that many are formal game theorists, and most even lack kind of the common sense side of things, just having navigated a business world and thought about cartel formation and industry oligopolies and things like that.
Yeah, I mean, I've definitely tried learning a bit about the game theory stuff, but most of my formal training has been in distributed systems. So kind of like cloud computing or massively scalable systems, like that's the world. So just to give you like some more context on where I was coming from. So I was coming from the world, our research community is the research community that built the internet, early internet protocols, that built data centers, that built like massively scalable storage systems. And when I discovered kind of like decentralized computing or Bitcoin and blockchains at that time, it was almost like we knew that the world is going to evolve from the cloud computing model, which is usually a single company is running the services for everyone, to decentralized computing, which has this very interesting angle. Like as soon as you try to make all of that stuff decentralized, like all sorts of problems kick in, like game theory, like incentives, like, you know, all these attacks that are otherwise not possible because the single company is responsible for protecting the infrastructure. And that's been kind of like the ride ever since, where we were explicitly doing like R&D work for a very long time before launching our kind of like full stack decentralized computing platform. And I know that right before this podcast, we were talking about like some of the different design decisions and having the base layer be more complex versus simple. And I'd love to actually pick up that thread again. And I think you were giving examples from PoliScience about having like a complex system and then having people interact with it versus having like a base layer that is very simple. And how does that impact things?
Yeah, I'll give my thoughts from the kind of non-technical side. And obviously that there's so many angles to this. So a heated discussion for at least the last few years in cryptocurrency has been kind of L1 scaling, first with Bitcoin, then with Ethereum. We at Blockdaw, for example, we run a Loom validator, which is a Ethereum sidechain. So trying to think about, there's so many angles. So with Bitcoin, you have things like the security model with transaction fees and concerns over it migrating, which I have no insight on at all. And as far as I can tell, there's no consensus yet. The angle at which I can maybe contribute or have a thought is more the human side, where in college I was a poli-sci major, and one thing you see almost everywhere in the world throughout all periods of human history is some form of federalism, where you have stronger government at the local level, less so at the higher level. A really simple example to illustrate why we all want that is imagine if there was a single world government and all rules applied equally. Asia would kind of control the world. And would you really want 51% of people in one hemisphere to be setting things like home ordinances, the color of your house? Like you think about the level of government in a neighborhood association, do you really want people on another continent deciding that for you? And the answer is, of course not. You're fine with the home association rule because it's voluntary, it's small, it's easy to move. Probably the people at home association are self-selecting and are probably fairly homogenous stakeholders. So the natural tendency we see is really simple rules at the global level where you have heterogeneous stakeholders and then more hands-on burdensome rules at a local level. So I think we're going to see the same thing in cryptocurrency. It seems very intuitive to me that's true from many angles, both the security side. When you think about security attack vectors, all governance is an attack vector. There are also a lot of benefits. There's a lot of things where you critically want it. So how do you kind of get both? Well, you have opt-in communities, whether that takes the form of smart contract or sidechains or L2s like Lightning. I'm not sure what form it'll take on the technology, but I think it's almost inevitable. It's really hard. Here's another framing. Like, you can't optimize for everything. You can't have the same vehicle be both the fastest race car and the most comfortable SUV and a great motorcycle to turn court, you know? So how do you get all of that on one platform? Well, like, take the internet. We have kind of the same underlying protocol, and then you have all these different apps that are optimized for very different things, right? I'd be really surprised to not see that happen in crypto. In fact, the only way I see that not happening is if there's such a giant technological revolution that L1 can do everything at a level where for 30 years we don't want anything else. It's hard to imagine that.
Yeah, that's actually a really fascinating way of looking at it. As soon as you said that, hey, we cannot have like a single government for the entire world, what I got reminded of was like this notion of a world computer, which is almost like a mainframe. Like, imagine a mainframe computer for the entire world, where every time any user is trying to do any action, there's a transaction that impacts every other user in the world, right? So that's like almost like it's not scalable by definition. Versus if you think about desktops, like desktops happened after mainframe computing. It's your own computer, and then you are installing software on it locally. You're not impacting anyone else in the world, and that's a scalable model. And then you also mentioned, you know, how the internet scales. Interestingly, like, there is this very explicit design principle in computer science. It's called the end-to-end design principle by David Clark. He's an MIT researcher who was the chief protocol architect of the internet. And my PhD thesis actually builds up on the end-to-end design principle and kind of like applies it to crypto, called the trust-to-trust design principle. But they basically effectively laid out the exact same rule that you have to keep the core of the network extremely, extremely simple, and complexity kind of like pushes towards the edges. And time again in distributed systems, we have seen that whenever there were two options available, one was complex at the core, the other was simple at the core. Over the course of years, the simple thing just almost always ends up winning. So, and I'm actually really surprised by the fascination a lot of the crypto projects have in terms of like doubling down on the complexity at the core, right? Like even proposed solutions like sharding and others, it's almost like if you look at the broader landscape, it seems like different projects are like, I will do sharding before you, right? And people are not asking the question that, is that even the right approach? Like, should you even be trying to attempt sharding at the blockchain layer?
I would actually love your, I'm going to say something that's probably wrong. So please shoot me down. So I was maybe mistakenly thinking about sharding as potentially part of that federalism model where individual shards can have their own customized everything. I know there's different security models, whether it's Polkadot or Ethereum shards may be very different in how they interact with the main chain. How should I be thinking about sharding in that regard?
First of all, like, just a little like historic context on sharding, that this is a concept mostly popularized in the databases community, where you actually understand the workloads really well. And if your workloads are contained within a shard, you can actually create kind of like one shard and then another shard. And then you're kind of like routing traffic to different shards, basically knowing that anything that you send to any specific shard, that workload is fully contained inside that shard, right? And it's not going to interact with other things. That's not the idea. So that's the basic concept from databases. It works well. And databases are usually run in a very centralized way anyway. So it's a very different environment in which these technologies work. Somehow that concept has been taken from databases because they help scale databases, applied to blockchains, where the first question that people should be asking is, do you have the similar types of workloads? And the answer is a clear no. If you just analyze even Ethereum's history, it's mostly like random access. It's very hard to predict what data our smart contracts are going to try and access. It is fairly random, the at least in the analysis that we have done from like publicly available data. What that translates into is that you would end up with a lot of like communication between shards, right? As soon as you start getting into that, you start getting into situations where nodes would need near global information to be able to participate in a meaningful way, because you have to stay updated on every shard that you are kind of like interacting with. So it kind of like kills the purpose of having shards in the first place. That's like just like one of the problems But the other problem is that I think people think of shards, at least in the Ethereum community, as a pretty much an L1 thing, right? Like they're not thinking of this like this is layer two that is going to come and settle at the base layer. They're almost thinking of sharding as the solution that scales L1, right? It's because of their communication between shards, it is effectively true as well, because those shards need global coordination and they need to work that way. And one way to think about this is like people try to think about, you know, transactions per second as a metric that they're trying to optimize. Again, in my view, it's absolutely the wrong metric to try and optimize. Think of it this way, that it doesn't matter how many transactions you're processing, because a transaction could have a lot of data or could have less data. You could be processing 1,000 transactions versus one really big transaction. What's limited there is the actual available bandwidth around the world and laws of physics. Like how fast can you send data from like one point in the world to another point on the world? Because any system that requires global coordination, and blockchains do, the limitations are the underlying pipes, basically, right? So the question to ask is, how fast can we send data from one point to another? And you should take that as kind of like a physical limitation. And then your system needs to work within those limitations. And those limitations are not going to change, right? So optimizing transactions per second is like almost like a vanity metric, because you already know the max amount of data that can be transferred on a global network. And your system basically needs to operate within it. What that translates into in practical terms is that there can be very little that can be done at the blockchain layer. And that's kind of like the approach that we take, you know, very simple base layer where you only do the things that absolutely must happen at the blockchain layer, And everything else is actually not on the blockchain layer at all. And there's a different angle to it. So this is the scalability angle. The other angle is that just the way the crypto industry has evolved, there's this notion that if you are interacting with the blockchain, you almost have to write a smart contract. Smart contracts are the only interface available. So even if you're building something like a Twitter client, the developers are forced to write a smart contract that then ends up sending transactions at the blockchain layer whenever you're tweeting, which just makes no sense from a scalability perspective or a cost perspective, because there's cost associated with every transaction. And programming languages have existed for such a long time, even before smart contracts. There are many more developers who are comfortable with just writing code in the languages that they prefer. And you don't have to force every single program in the world to now be a smart contract.
What is it? I would love for you to clarify a little bit. What does it mean for that code the programmer is writing to be a smart contract versus not?
A smart contract is basically, in my view, something where you publish either the source code itself, which is what we do in our smart contract language, or you publish the compiled code. So every node on the global network has the same view of what is it that I'm trying to process, right? And then whenever those contracts have any state changes, right? So there's a transaction, there's a state change, that's a global event that everyone on the network has to be updated on, right? So there is this notion of independent execution, like any node can execute the same thing, and they agree that this is the exact same thing that we are trying to execute on. And this notion of global state changes, that the smart contract is now, let's say it's a transfer of digital assets. Everyone on the network would agree that the asset transferred from here to there, right? So that's, in my view, is kind of like smart contract that is pushed on chain and is being executed on chain. Whereas normal programming languages, if you're running a desktop program on your machine, nobody in the world like cares about it. Only you care about it, and only you are kind of like interfacing with that program. Imagine almost like a word processor. There is like one of the apps on Blockstack called Graphite. It's a word processor. Every time you're interacting with that software, there are actions, there are state changes internally with the program. They're not hitting the blockchain layer at all, as they shouldn't. If you would force that program to be a smart contract, you're suddenly making it like a global thing where you're working in your Word doc and you're putting load on the blockchain, which is just not scalable.
So I'm framing it in my head as you want to move business logic, or in many cases, out of the smart contract onto a local environment.
It's mostly like you want to write programs in a way where most of the complexity is at the edges, meaning the users, right? And only the things where a global state change is required, right, is expressed as a smart contract, where and that is executed as a smart contract. Let me build up on the Twitter example a little bit. So let's say that there's a Twitter built in the Blockstack way. Over there, if a user is registering a universal ID and it's unique, that's a global event. Like I got, you know, Muneeb.id, and that's a global event. But that is proportional to the number of total users, right? Because the same ID is used with every single application. So every time someone is using a new app, you don't have to create that global event. Similarly, when the developer is publishing kind of like a new version of the software, the developer would publish the app at the blockchain layer because it's a global event. Everyone now should use this new version of the software. But every time that I am trying to tweet or follow, like it is something that I locally care about. I care about the people that I follow, right? My software can fetch that data and construct a view for me, which is my Twitter feed, locally for me. And it doesn't need to be a global event. Like other people don't care about what my feed looks like.
So I was going to ask, are things like counterfactual instantiation or sidechains along that vein? But it seems to, maybe it's like a middle ground where like a sidechain is still kind of set up to be pseudo decentralized. I mean, you could run one yourself, but it's not, you're suggesting for many usages, you really just want like a local kind of desktop environment for many things. It's almost weird that there hasn't been more exploration of that on other platforms, because I don't know that it's incongruent. Like I imagine you could do something like that with Ethereum, but I haven't seen many.
Yes, I think technically it is possible, but it is almost like a school of thought, right? The school of thought it's not just Ethereum, right? Like it's EOS, it's Definity, a lot of these projects. If you look at the technical solutions, if you squint your eyes, like if you forget about some of the details, most of them are trying to do proof of stake. Most of them are trying to do Turing complete languages. Most of them are coming around to this compiler, WebAssembly. Like everything basically runs through WebAssembly. And people are almost like not asking the questions that why have we sort of like settled on all these approaches, including sharding. Like sharding seems to be like the holy grail of scaling. And I'm sitting here saying that sharding might be the absolute worst approach to even attempt, right? And same thing with WebAssembly. Like that compiler was originally built to make JavaScript faster. If you take a step back and ask yourself the question, is that the problem that we're trying to solve with smart contracts? The answer is clearly no. JavaScript is a horrible language to begin with. Making it faster is not the problem that smart contracts are trying to solve. The problem that we are trying to solve with smart contracts is you want to optimize for security. You want to optimize for predictability, right? I don't care how long it takes for a smart contract to run, if it's a minute or like 20 seconds, 30 seconds, I don't care. What I care about is when it is moving a digital asset, when it is dealing with people's money, there are absolute guarantees that the contract does what it's supposed to do and doesn't do other things, right? So it's almost like, again, asking the question that what are we really trying to optimize for versus just running with the flow. It almost feels like Ethereum initially set the direction because it was the kind of like the first project that has general purpose smart contracts. And then other projects are trying to operate within the same direction that Ethereum originally started towards. And they're not asking the question that is that direction should be the direction that we should be going in.
I'll tell you that I think the way this plays out in practice is like there were just recently headlines about a lot of white papers being outsourced to like shadow writers. Those are generally projects we probably wouldn't be talking about. Like you and I would kind of know are not worth looking at anyway. That's like the really extreme case where people are hiring white paper writers to write what they think people want to get investment. But I think that kind of thing is happening everywhere. And part of it is because the number of people who can have an intelligent debate about sharding in the crypto community is so limited, right? So even people like myself who are theoretically, at least allocators, if not experts, I think what happens is you have something like Ethereum, a handful of thought leaders, true technical experts will say, this looks promising, this looks interesting, which might be a reasonable early stage idea. And then sharding sounded sexy and cool. And so you have kind of the angel investors and the retail speculators are like, oh, sharding, first to market, 10,000 transactions per second, that kind of thing. They throw money at it. Then you have all these other projects that say, oh, that's how you raise 50 million. You say you're gonna be first to market with sharding. And then you get credible engineers working on it because there's clearly demand for it. It isn't at least a fake idea. Like it may be horribly suboptimal in a wrong-headed direction. But I think it's really tough for an investor to gauge. You know, there's so few, like even within crypto, even among the technical experts, there aren't that many people who can, because it's not even just a pure technical question, right? It's also kind of an applied, like in practical usage, as this thing will be used, is this an intelligent approach?
That's why I keep coming back to whenever people talk about like, hey, what does crypto need? My first answer is usually like, it needs more computer scientists. Like in the sense that I've noticed like very stark difference between, I would say cloud computing and crypto, where in cloud computing, there is clearly like established computer scientists who speak the same language, who agree on the terms that we are going to use to communicate with each other. There are these well-established conferences. So imagine that, you know, Amazon Dynamo was published at, you know, some of these distributed systems conferences that we publish at. Same with Google Spanner. So imagine the system, Google Spanner, that is responsible for scaling Google internally in terms of their data stores. It's massively scalable to hundreds of millions of users. It was published by researchers like us at the conferences that we go to. In crypto is like so far away from that place where I think there are only a handful of people like Amin Gunserer from Cornell, who is from that community, who understands it, and he's very deep. And I think the dialogue that appears, because these works are able to build up on each other, they can like compare and contrast without fighting with each other, right? Whereas in crypto, if I publicly disagree from a purely technical perspective with some approach, right, there is a lot of baggage involved in that. Like I think we recently got pulled into some of the Ethereum scalability research. And my comments are usually that I think those guys are so far off, or the technical solutions are so like pie in the sky that I can't even comment. And then people would push us. And I think we recently did this public review of Casper CPC.
I read that and enjoyed it.
Yeah. So it was like, it took us a lot of time to even like, you know, understand what was written in that paper, because it's like non-standard. Like this is not how traditional distributed systems research is done. And then imagine that we are at a stage where, we are like, hey, this is not Byzantine fault tolerance. This is not the definition of Byzantine fault tolerance. And at some point, Vlad is saying, yes, my definition is different, right? And then if you look at that paper, so Byzantine fault tolerance is a very well understood concept for decades in the distributed systems community. If you look at the set of things you need to prove to say that this is a Byzantine fault tolerant algorithm, and you look at the set of things proved in the Casper CPC paper, there's zero overlap. Right. So something is like that off, but how do we politely bring it up in the community, right? And without having like a lot of people like jumping on you, and especially when you have a competitive project in the space.
So I thought it was a great exchange. Your write-up was kind of neutral in tone, I thought. And it was interesting seeing like there was a little bit of an initial reaction being like, oh, Blockstack just destroyed Vlad and Ethereum. And then other people being like, you know, kind of taking the other politics. It's like, you looked at it, it's like, no, this is just a respectful kind of academic, or I assume respectful regardless of the intentions. It was framed in an academic criticism kind of way. And at least I only saw this publicly from your and Vlad's kind of public interactions, but it, you know, certainly seemed respectful and fact-based in a search for truth. What was amazing to me was almost like how little coverage it got, or how like the number of people who read your criticism, it's, you know, such a tiny fraction of the Ethereum community and Ethereum investors, even though it's so critical to the whole model. A frequent challenge for me is I'm a contrarian by nature, a debater. I learn through debating. It's very frustrating to me when I encounter like the religion and politics of crypto, where it's like, I'm not attacking Bitcoin. I'm trying to explore Eclipse attacks. Like Satoshi acknowledged that this was a vulnerability. Like we can talk about it. It doesn't mean I hate Bitcoin, right? Like, why can't we just have an honest discussion? You know, and if I say something wrong, correct me. I'll admit I'm wrong. But yeah, I mean, there's a lot of money at stake. There's a lot of egos at stake. And there's the ratio of pundits to expertise is tiny. And I include myself on the pundit side.
Yeah. And I think just to give an example of some positive things in the community as well, like I would bring up Juan from Filecoin, right? So I guess our situation is a little bit different because we went through Y Combinator together. We were in the same batch and, you know, we go way back. But if you look at some of the technical solutions that Juan is working on, sometimes I disagree with the approach, right? But there is deep respect on both sides. Like we're friends, we hang out, and we can disagree on the technology. And sometimes like people would ask me like, how is your Gaia storage system different from Filecoin? And I'll describe the approach that we are taking, why we are taking it. And I would acknowledge that the problem that Juan has taken on is from a technical perspective, a very, very challenging one, because he's trying to solve for incentives. Like how would people just plug in their drives into like this massive system and have the right incentives to do that and keep those drives online. And if he solves that problem, we can potentially use it. Like similarly, if someone can actually solve, you know, L1 scaling, which I think is actually from a purely laws of physics perspective, it's impossible. But somehow magic happens, like, you know, and they can. We are open to using that scientific breakthrough, right? But we can have that mutual respect and have that debate and agree on basic terminology so that people can start building on knowledge. Like there is like so much knowledge available already from peer-to-peer systems. Like most of these protocols, like Swarm that works with Ethereum in terms of data storage or IPFS, they use Kademlia as the peer-to-peer kind of like routing mechanism at the heart. Kademlia came out in around 2000, right? And people have studied the hell out of it, like over like 10 years or so. And a lot of crypto projects, like it almost like died off in a way, other than, you know, BitTorrent is probably the only like massive scale project that came out that people are still using. But most of the peer-to-peer projects effectively died off, right, in 2005, 2006. And people had lots of learnings from this early peer-to-peer era. And then some of the same people, and at that time, imagine like the top computer scientists in the world were actually working on peer-to-peer computing. And most of them moved into cloud computing because they were like, these problems are very hard to solve in a peer-to-peer decentralized manner. We're just going to build like these data centers and cloud networks. And there is so much learning that is available if people are actually trying to go through, talk to the people who were involved in that era, look at the research material that was produced and some of the lessons learned. And then there, again, like a shining light on the positive side, there are some people who remember that era, who were part of that era. Zuku is one of them. Bram is one of them, and obviously he's working on Chia now with all those lessons in mind. And I think it's very interesting. We actually did a podcast with him where I was basically silent and letting him make the same points that I would have made about some of these design decisions by Ethereum and others.
Are you guys going to be integrating any Craig Wright innovations into Blockstack?
I would be skeptical that there would be any innovations coming from that.
Yeah, pure joke. Not that I've reviewed every one of his 1,000 patents, but there's going to be fireworks, I think, or hope. It's going to be very entertaining, a fun movie. A lot of what I try to do in the poker world and thinking things through is a little bit more the poker side in terms of like, this is a tiny industry. This is more on the investment trading side, but tiny industry, small number of key players. And it's very much like a poker game. And that if you can try to figure out, you know, okay, there's 10 people at this table, it's like a poker table. And that those might be the founders of the project, a handful of key whales, exchange operators, custodians, you think about like SegWit2x, who kind of determine the outcome. It's a pretty small number of key players. So I usually try to think about like, what is this person's position? What's their worldview? What's their incentive? And therefore, how do I interpret their actions through that? And with Craig, it's just bizarre because like it seems, I'll welcome the libel suit, but the evidence we have is that it seems like he submitted forged documents to a US court, like clearly forged documents, it seems. That appear to have been backdated. And that's just a really weird choice, a really weird play. Like, how does that... my hypothesis is that he was threatening the libel so that when people Googled him or Enchain, who weren't in the crypto world and saw all the scam stuff, he could say, oh, that's just libel and I'm suing them. And it kind of lends credibility to the dismissal, saying I'm suing these people. But submitting clearly forged documents to U.S. court, I just don't see how you win from that.
You think that that was something that where they thought that they're smart enough that people won't be able to tell that these are clearly forged documents?
I don't know. Those documents were exposed at least a year ago, some of them at least. I mean, the email backdating is not rocket science. Like, I've seen the analysis, and there's so many that even if any one of them is wrong, like, there's just so many, you know, the forging of cryptographic proof. He's referenced Bitcoin addresses that weren't active until after the date of the reference, like clear backdating, and like where you don't even need to do forensics. Like, you're just like, the date of this email is this. This Bitcoin address didn't have any Bitcoin in it until 2 weeks after you said in the email that you sent 10,000 Bitcoin to it. So he has to know that the stuff is being debunked and exposed. And this is not like contentious. Like, at least my very limited understanding of how you like show the backwardation of the email is something a U.S. judge can follow with, you know, expert testimony.
Yeah.
So I don't know. It's weird. You kind of want rational actors. Like, if you're playing poker, it's actually easier to beat the person who's bad but rational than the person who's totally random. Person who's totally random, you'll beat them, but not by as big a margin, because you can't like outplay them every hand. You kind of have to just play probability.
And I think James Lopp is about to come up with some report as well.
He teased that on Twitter.
Yeah.
I don't know what he's teasing, but it should be. I'm always a fan of James' work. So
yeah, work. He's very thorough. I really enjoyed his article in the New York Times as well, where I think Nathaniel Popper was covering how he
vanished.
He vanished, and I think it was a very fascinating.
It's insane. I'm obviously a pretty public figure, as you are. It's something I've thought about a lot. At the moment, it's advantageous in many ways for me to be public. I think of it almost as binary. Like, the first step to securely storing cryptocurrency is to not tell anyone you have it. I have a couple of very smart friends that swear to me they don't own any, but I'm pretty sure they're just really smart at custody, which is, you don't tell anyone that you own it. So if you're going to be public about having it and make yourself a target, if you're running a business or fundraising or building a project, there's benefits to that. But if you're not, you should probably be as kind of secretive as, and I'm pretty paranoid about security. And what the steps Jameson had to take to kind of go halfway, because it's not like he really vanished. Like, you look at, like, I don't think he'd be that hard to find, frankly. And the amount of work he had to do to just get to that halfway point is just astronomical. It's so burdensome.
But I do think it's something that more and more people would start worrying about, like similar stuff, as your assets are in crypto currencies, or you're kind of like responsible for the security setup of your own private keys and stuff. I remember, like, when we did our token offering in 2017 and we raised like approximately $50 million, one of the first reactions that I visibly remembered was I took off the Blockstack tag from my backpack and the stickers from my laptop. Like, if I'm sitting in a random coffee shop, I don't want people to know that I'm from Blockstack. And similarly, like in our SEC filing, we actually made a point to disclose like some information about crypto holdings, like how no single employee, including myself, actually even has access. You can't even do anything like if you just come and talk to me in terms of getting access to crypto. It's almost like if there's a sophisticated party who's doing their research, here's a public filing, and there's a description of like our security practices, which also means that no employee really has access to any of the crypto holdings anyway.
That's the only long-term solution. So I'm a huge believer, like my general framing on crypto is it's a tool, I care about it as a tool for the 1%, not the 1% elite, but the 1% oppressed or 10% in China, probably 20% of people who won't be able to access public transportation soon because of their social media scoring system. With that said, it benefits those people more if it's big, if there's all sorts of infrastructure around it. I want the Venezuelan who flees to be able to like use a Bitcoin ATM in any city in Europe. And that requires abstraction. And the only way I think people are generally going to get comfortable, like the idea of sending $10 million copying and pasting an alphanumeric string is so absurd. Like, it's so comically absurd. Like, I think in 3 years, I'll look back on like, you know, I have a price alert go off at 2 a.m. and I'm transferring a huge amount of money groggy, which is terrifying, right? So we're moving towards good third-party custody, just the industry as a whole. most people will want it. You shouldn't have to use it. You should be able to store your own keys. I would encourage people who need it for that purpose to do it. But if you're a pension, an endowment, a fund manager, or an average individual, you probably trust a third party more than you trust yourself on the security side. I mean, I do, right? So I'll tell you my own standard. We self-custodied when we launched because you had to. There kind of wasn't any alternative. We'll be entirely third-party custodied by the end of this year, I think. And the transition for me was I need to trust the third party more than I trust myself, which obviously can't happen on the personal side. I trust myself. But on the security side, I'd like to think I'm pretty good by industry standards, but nothing compared to the world's best experts in terms of they're talking about piping in extra sources of entropy into HSMs. And, there's some really brilliant minds kind of working on it. So we're going to get there to the point where I would personally trust the third-party custodian more than I trust myself. Because this is maybe an interesting topic. Something that kind of scares me in an existential sense is all tech is breakable. Right? So whether it's brute forcing an algorithm, quantum computing, whether it's man-in-the-middle attacks, you have viruses that can hop air-gap devices. Like, we go through a crazy process custodying our private keys that involves, like, shrink wrap and glitter, and it's like NSA best practices to prevent someone placing a hardware keylogger on a device. But the number of holes, and it's like basically what I'm really relying on is that I'm not targeted by the NSA, right? That because there's no way, like, the viruses that can hop air gap devices on USB sticks weren't known to exist until after the fact. And I was like, oh wow, the NSA invented this 5 years ago, and now, like, we knew it could exist, but now it actually exists. So my concern, though, is not just crypto. So you could say this is that a criticism of crypto? How can we base world money on something that's breakable? But that's just modern life, right? If modern life is going to increasingly depend on encryption and on just tech, how do we almost survive that as human society? I'm actually not sure how it plays out, because we can intermediate risk, we can have insurance, we can have great custodians, and you as an individual can feel comfortable by kind of spreading out that risk with levels of insurance or whatever. But that just creates systemic risk. Right. If everyone's using SHA-256 or everyone's using the same HSM kind of construction, I mean, now most HSMs are made by the same one manufacturer. But even if that wasn't the case, you know, you still have kind of a set of best practices. I mean, when we launched, we were using Trezor, for example, and then you had the DEF CON where it was revealed that you could hack them with a paperclip. We immediately switched. And I'm not trying to attack them. It's a great device if you have physical control over it. But my point was, like, you didn't know that could happen. At least I didn't. Yeah. So how do we live in modern life with that issue?
Yeah, I think there are two very interesting things here. One is that as, let's say, you're going to a custodian, or you're going to some partner, or even an exchange like Coinbase, and they offer certain services for keeping even long-term storage for cryptocurrency. And you start getting this pushback that, hey, this wasn't the kind of like dream of crypto, where you're like now relying on third parties again. And at first I want to point out our philosophy there. We really believe in freedom to exit. And I think that's a very important, almost like a digital right. And this applies to cryptocurrencies, where I have the freedom to exit Coinbase whenever I want, because the Bitcoins are going to travel on a decentralized network, and they can go to another exchange. And Coinbase is always kind of like going to operate with that model in mind, that they can lose their customers to other exchanges. This is very different from being able to exit Facebook, right? Or other centralized parties. And in many ways, the work we are doing is enabling freedom to exit for these apps, so that you can exit Facebook as easily as you can withdraw your Bitcoins from a wallet or an exchange. So I think, like, that shifts the control to the users. And then it's the user's decision if they want to trust a third party and they feel more comfortable. Or maybe you want to do risk mitigation, where a certain amount of crypto is under your own keys, certain amount is with one provider and with some other provider, and so on. So that's one thing. Then the other thing is about purely the technical risk. And the framework that I have in my mind is really about, are the best people in the world thinking about these problems? And I think one thing that crypto has done is that suddenly security is like front and center for a lot of these like really bright minds and a lot of these engineers, where like I went through efforts to hire some of the best minds I've ever worked with for Blockstack. And those people were skeptical of blockchain, skeptical of crypto. But once, you know, they got over those initial kind of like skepticism of like, what is this industry, so much like hype in it and stuff like that, and they got really into the weeds, they would themselves like go out of their way to even like try and improve on existing security protocols, like the Glacier protocol. Like when we were, you know, kind of like starting our blockchain, there was a crazy ceremony that we decided not to like publicly write about it because better if we keep the details to ourselves. But these bright minds are now themselves going on and trying to like constantly improve on various aspects of security, right? And that's what you want. It's almost always going to be kind of like this arms race where the attackers are becoming more and more sophisticated, and then the defenders are becoming more and more sophisticated. And the only way to really operate here is to make sure that the right amount of importance is given to this aspect, and the right people, the right good guys are kind of like working on it. And I am always confident in the ability of kind of like the top minds in the world, that if you present the right problems to them, explain exactly why these are so important, and have the right financial incentives in place, that we would basically keep innovating.
So I think my concern is over the asymmetry. So, and this applies in so much in distributed systems and cryptocurrency, where if you're secure 99.99% of the time, but there's a systemic failure, you're potentially just done. So you need to be a step ahead of the security failures, like every step of the way. You need to be ahead of SHA-256 breaking, ahead of quantum computing, ahead of, right? Because any one, you know, 2 hours of lapse potentially shut down the world, right? I'm not just talking about crypto, but shut down the financial system, shut down. I mean, like the pessimistic framing is in a cat and mouse game. At some point, the cat has the advantage. At some point. And in a literal cat and mouse game, that one time the mouse is dead.
Yeah.
There is no next game. I don't know. I don't have a good framing on this. Maybe I'm too pessimistic. In some ways, many people who think about this have been shocked at how few systemic problems we've had along that regard, both on the tech side, also on things like germ warfare, a little bit of similar thinking around mutually assured destruction with nuclear weapons. It almost seems like a surprise that we haven't had those kind of calamities. I was an electricity trader 10 years ago, and it was suspected at the time that it was China, and I don't know if that's been confirmed, but like people are pretty sure they hacked some of the power grids. At one point, they hacked the Midwest power grid and took the entire thing down for a day. And it's like shockingly easy to like take down a power grid. They're all hackable. I mean, it's pretty easy to get access. And basically, you like short one little wire and the entire thing overloads because it wasn't really built to deal with that kind of malicious attack. But it seemed like they did it as a test. They deliberately did very little damage. And the hypothesis was actually they didn't want to take the network down. They were just probing and they were just kind of seeing what they could do. But the scary thing is, well, what if they had wanted to do damage, right? That was one grid. And they like deliberately did as little as they, you know, it seems like it was an accident that they messed anything up. So it's almost amazing that we haven't had like, you know, a 2 week long systemic power outage in the US.
Yeah. So I completely see this asymmetry where the attackers just need to find like one bug that they can exploit. And even if you were being extremely careful for years and years, suddenly, you know, all of your crypto is gone. But I think like my reasons for being having like a more of a positive attitude about this is just relative progress. Like if you look at the industry as a whole, look at SSL. Like it was maintained by like a single individual, and then, you know, Heartbleed happened, and there was like so much attention over, oh wow, this could be potentially really bad for so many businesses. And if you look at like how these open source security libraries were built pre-Bitcoin and pre-blockchains, and the amount of resources, just financial resources or attention going to these projects, I think it's an order of magnitude difference now. Like it's almost like 100x or 1000x better now with crypto networks, where some of the same libraries for encryption, decryption are now getting a lot more security reviews, a lot more resources attached to it, a lot more. Basically what changed was incentives. Like think of a Linux server. We actually ran that exercise, that if you're running a Linux server on a cloud, like Amazon or DigitalOcean or whatever, the incentive for engineers to securing that server wasn't a lot, but if there are hot private keys on that server, suddenly you're actually spending a lot of engineering cycles to make sure that that server is actually super secure, which is good for security in general.
Also from the other side, giant bug bounty, right? So you're gonna have a lot of security research from the black hatters, and hopefully they, when they prove concepts, it'll be small. Like, I think it's wonderful that, for example, we've had some proof of work attacks, like Ethereum Classic. Wonderful in the sense that that's something Bitcoin could face. Like, let's see it on, it's funny, Ethereum Classic is actually above where it was when that happened. I was gonna say, maybe not so good for the holders of that asset, although they actually weren't even hurt by it. That's, from my perspective, that's great. That's like anti-fragile, right? We want to see small systems break so we can learn from them. I guess my concern is that we both are, clearly agree that you want kind of this simple base infrastructure layer. The danger there is that's, very fragile. Like you're exposed to kind of a single systemic risk. That'll be interesting to see play out. This then touches on the social side. So like the financial system doesn't worry about this that much because there's the fallback to legal. So if hackers change an account balance in a Chase account, give themselves $10 billion, they know they're not going to get away with it. It's just going to get reversed. When they try to get away with it, they try to do it. It's a timing issue. Like I think it was the Bank of Indonesia had like $200 million stolen. And they did it as like a long holiday weekend. They disabled like the printers inside so the people would be distracted and not get it. Literally, they disabled like the printer that prints out the giant wires the bank does. And so the people inside, there was another 24 hours where they didn't know it was happening. And that let the thieves kind of move the money around enough. With crypto, I've heard the same thing suggested. So like Andreas Antonopoulos, he used to give talks. He may still, but this was something like, I feel like this isn't like debated often, but this was a debate I had a couple years ago where I would say, people would say, hey, miners can't hurt Bitcoin at all because users can just blacklist them. And I was like, what does that mean? Like practice speaking, what does it mean? And Andreas Antonopoulos in his old talks would throw that out as kind of almost a given. He'd be like, anyone who says governments can censor Bitcoin or miners or consortium or 100 or 99% of hash power can censor it are idiots because we would just block them. It's like, what do you mean by that? Like how you're saying the users of Bitcoin as a whole would in a dynamic ongoing way blacklist a rotating set of IP addresses based on what? I don't think I could do that. And I'm just not that I have any technical expertise, but I'm like doing this full time and I don't think I could keep up with it. You know, Muneeb, really a pleasure and an honor to be in your offices and chat with you and appreciated the both interesting exploration and also educating me on a few topics.
Yeah, absolutely. This was great. I almost feel like we could have gone on for another hour or so. And
I think sure.
We would actually like love to chat more, maybe bring you back as a guest on this podcast.
It would be a pleasure.
This has been the Stacks Podcast. You can follow Ari Paul on Twitter at Ari David Paul and Muneeb at Muneeb. And I'm at Zach Valenti. If you like this episode, please consider leaving a rating or review for the show wherever you listen to podcasts. To learn more about building decentralized apps, please visit blockstack.org. The music in this episode is by Andrew Apple Pie. Check out andrewapplepie.com for more. Until next time, thank you for listening.